Welcome to the Real Estate Syndication Show. Whether you are a seasoned investor or building a new real estate business, this is the show for you. Whitney Sewell talks to top experts in the business. Our goal is to help you master real estate syndication. And now your host, Whitney Sewell.
This is your daily real estate syndication show. I'm your host, Whitney Sewell. Today, our guest is Nick Moore. Thanks for being on the show, Nick.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Nick is a commercial real estate and corporate attorney located in Atlanta, Georgia. Having assisted clients with multi-millions in real estate deals, Nick guides his clients from the inception of the deal to post-close business matters and everything in between. Nick is also a general partner in commercial real estate and has assisted in the formation of private equity funds, limited partnerships, syndications, debt securities, and corporate structure revisions to accomplish his clients' complex objectives. In 2020, Nick was selected by Super Lawyers as a Georgia rising star for the areas of corporate and business, which is reserved for the top 2.5% of attorneys in the practice area. When he's not taking down deals with his clients, he enjoys hiking, golfing, spending time with his church, and staying active in his faith. Nick, welcome to the show. Grateful for your time. Knowing somebody like yourself is a must for anyone in our business. And I think, you know, whether you're a sponsor or whether you're just a passive investor, you need somebody like yourself on your team. So thank you again for your time. Get us started with a little bit of who you are, what you do specifically in commercial real estate. I know we highlighted it a little bit, but then we're going to jump into just your superpower and take maybe the listener through just that transactional timeline and some pitfalls and things like that to help prevent them.
For sure. And thank you for the introduction. That was so close to what I do that you would have thought I wrote it. And I did. So, absolutely. Appreciate it. I got started in commercial real estate 2012, working on McDonald's deals. And then just ratcheted up from there, just started doing the multifamily assets, picked that up, do the closing, all the contract work. I work with the GPs and the LPs as well. So when we're talking syndications, obviously our GP is the general partnership. Those are the guys running the deal. LPs, of course, are our investors. Kind of got my feet wet a little bit doing some contract work for another larger law firm and just picked up the material. Really loved the clients. Everyone just gets so excited about income producing real estate and specifically the multifamily that it was really just contagious. And there's nothing like being a lawyer and having your clients with good spirits. I do some litigation as well and have had some success with that. And you know, it's a little bit different. It's adversarial. Tensions run high. The clients already think they're right before they even bring it to you. So you have to do everything you can to prove them right while someone's trying to prove you wrong. But with the commercial real estate, it's just so easy to enjoy it and to know that you're building and that you're in some form or fashion, incidentally, providing security to your clients' families. People are sometimes in it for wealth. Some are in it for security for their families, whether it's passive and using the money that they've made in their career and parlaying that into a better opportunity. And there is no better opportunity than multifamily real estate, self-storage, and these other income-producing assets. And so I serve as general counsel as well externally to quite a number of companies. That gives me the opportunity to go through these contracts that I do on a daily basis. And then again, my litigation experience, I know how to phrase these things to avoid litigation or to prepare for some contingency that's going to help you out and something that we wouldn't have to get into a big dispute about. I can just point to the language and say, hey, here's obviously the intent. And that's just been a tremendous value, number one, for my GPs. Now, on the LP side, I've been able to review PPMs, other agreements there, and tell them, you know, kind of here's what the group can do, here's what you can't do, here's your rights, here's how your waterfalls work, et cetera. So just getting in and mixing up the deals, you know, like I said, just kind of fall in love with the subject matter. Fast forward here, you know, almost 6 or 7 years of doing this on a daily basis.
No, that's awesome. I've had different LPs or passive investors ask me about, well, should I have, you know, an attorney review the PPM or those documents? And I've had some LPs mention that, like, they've asked an attorney to review it and they won't on the LP side. And I just thought it's interesting. Is there something about that the LP needs to know about or why maybe one attorney wouldn't do that for them versus another one like yourself?
Yeah, of course. It's a great question. And I don't want to speculate as to what individual right. attorneys would opine. And I know you weren't asking that. But if anybody tells you that you shouldn't consult an attorney, that's the end of the advice from that individual. Hands down. Okay. that's where you go. Thank you very much. And then digress to a different topic. Why they wouldn't review the PPM is because, A, they may not understand it. We're talking about 150-page thereabout document that is very content-specific. The implications of the language can vary in terms of how do you earn your money? What's the preferred yeah. return look like? What's the waterfall? What are these hurdles? What's the success fee on the front end? What's the divestment fee on the back end? Can I get my units back? These different things that if you don't work on it on the front end transactionally, it's going to look like Greek. To review right. it and try and describe this. And then the other thing is charging for that. I think sometimes attorneys actually shy away from work when they find it difficult to determine how to bill it. So what I do for okay. LPs is I give them 90 minutes. I bill at a particular rate. So I'll give you an hour and a half. And that gives me enough time to go through this PPM comfortably. I'm not scrolling through, you know, of course I know what to look.
I was going to say, you're familiar enough that you know what to look for. It's not some other attorney that maybe has a different specialty that this is kind of out of their wheelhouse. You know, it's like asking the knee surgeon to perform brain surgery, right? You know,
or look at the brain scan. You know, that's kind of what it is. It's, yeah. it's not so much even the surgery as much as like, hey, check out this slide. You're like, well, I'm used to looking at knees, you know, but let right, me take a right. look at that. You're exactly well, right.
Let's jump into the transactional timeline. I want us to be able to hit that before we run out of time. Go through that timeline. I'd love for you to, you know, just highlight some pitfalls and how to prevent them, you know, thinking through that, the transactional timeline of purchasing commercial property.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously you want to start with the LOI, right? That's our letter of intent. When you go and you find interest and you underwrite a deal and you want to make an offer on it, you want to put some terms in the LOI that are not going to be such a surprise once we go to execute the PSA. That's going to shorten the timeline of executing the PSA. So you're not, hey, I had no idea you're going to ask for these things in due diligence or that you wanted these timelines with the inspection period or due diligence and the financing period or closing or extensions and some of these other things. So my LOIs, very comprehensive, have a lot of that in it so they know what to expect. So when I go ahead and release the PSA for red lines, there's very little to red line. Okay. The LOI is accepted and it's signed. The PSA is submitted. So the timeline should look like this, ideally. Okay. Your inspection period is historically about 30 days. I've seen a little bit less. I've seen a little bit more. Sometimes the buyer wants more. Sometimes the seller wants less. You just have to negotiate that. But you don't want the inspection period to start at the effective date of the PSA because that's really the date of execution. The inspection period should really begin when you receive all the documents that you've requested, right? Because you don't want to have a 30-day timeline that runs from signature and then 21 days later, you're still waiting on a T-12 to evaluate the expenses on the property or operating statements or insurance loss runs or whatever you need as part of your due diligence. So we typically put in my critical dates checklist the date on which we received all of those documents. And then 30 calendar days, and calendar and business days, obviously an important distinction. Typically, it's calendar days. 30 calendar days from then would be the end of the due diligence period. Now, I also like to put in a little qualifier there for a property approval notice. Okay, and the property approval notice has to be an affirmative document or communication from us to them at their notice. You put the property approval notice in there to let them know, hey, we reviewed all the documents. We're going to proceed. Now, most often, okay, the seller is going to want the property to be sold as is. So once you provide that property approval notice, you kind of waived your issues with any of the documents that you received in due diligence up until that point. Now, if you have reps and warranties, there's certain things that you can put in there. If you know that there may be an issue with the roof, the laundry room, unit 12, you know, these other things you want to put in there that can continue past inspection, make sure that they are responsible for some of the things that you addressed in due diligence. So let's say you went and did either in an appraisal or you went and toured the property and you found some patent defects, things that are noticeably issues. You want to bring those up and make sure that those survived the inspection period and that they didn't merge in with the property approval notice. The reason that's important is historically the earnest money that you put down, which is give or take 1% of the purchase price, goes hard typically at the end of the inspection period. So once I submit that property approval notice, money goes hard, you're not getting it back. you got to go do your financing, find your lender, get all that, and then do your syndication, PPMs, all that jazz. Okay. Now, one of the things that we've done of late, particularly in the COVID era, is try to make the earnest money not go hard until the end of financing, because it's been so difficult to get financing, whether through Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, conventional even. Don't really recommend SBA, high fees. So everybody just, you know, I'm not going to knock the SBA. It can be useful, but I don't think it should be option number one in my experience. That being said, earnest money doesn't go hard until the end of financing. Now, financing will either historically run concurrent with the inspection period, and a lot of times will run beginning on the effective date, okay? But if you want to, you can work it in there because it's a negotiating point, as all these are, okay? You want to put your financing period about 60 days from the expiration of the inspection period. That's going to give you enough time to work with the bank. Nobody's feeling the pressure. You're not going to lose out on earnest money, and you're not going to have to contribute more money under the extension. Because a lot of times what you'll work into the deal is the option to extend the closing. Historically, I've done 0.25% of the purchase price put into escrow. Again, it's non-refundable because at that point, we've already moved out of the due diligence period. Okay. Now, it still can be, but that would be put into escrow and applied for the purchase price later down the road. But that's the consideration for the extension. Any option is basically a new contract that you're exercising has to be scored by consideration. So you have to have a dollar value on that. Okay. But you put in there, if you know on the front end kind of what the terms you want in finance, and you go ahead and put those down in the PSA and say, hey, we're looking for something in the 5% interest rate range. We want a 25-year amortization. We want a 10-year note, balloon payment, 3 years interest only. And try and put that in there to give yourself that opportunity that, hey, if you don't get it, you can back out of the deal and get your earnest money back. I have fortunately never lost earnest money with a client. Yeah, and I've also in litigation had people bring me issues where they probably should have lost their earnest money. I was able to get it back. Okay, so just be very careful. You don't want to wager 1% of $3 million, which is 30 grand, on not knowing what's going on, oversight on certain timelines. So the financing contingency is very important. Now, what I do to hedge on costs is I don't go and file any of the registrations or any of these things until we get enough into the financing period that we've obtained the financing from the lender. Then we can start discussing the PPMs and getting your operating agreements and registering these entities that have a fixed cost on them as well. And so those measures together are going to create a safe environment for you to go take your deal down. There's a plenty of outs, and it's very easy to point to the language. A lot of times, last point on it, the earnest money is typically held by a third-party escrow. Well, they can't release that earnest money without consent from both sides. I like to hold my client's investor funds because I'm not subject to that full party consent. And if something goes south, I don't want them holding the investor's funds and have a derivative action or a direct action come against my client. I'll just go ahead and release that back to the investors, or I can at least report to them, hey, I'm counsel on this. We have your funds. We are working through some issues on the PSA. I'm either going to hold it until we resolve that, or I'm just going to go ahead and return it to you, and then we can work through the issues on the PSA.
The financial contingency thing is so important. And I know we've had some sellers that recently, even after COVID, you know, all this mess now, or I would say 8 months ago, it's like you had to go hard with hundreds of thousands of dollars on day one, or else you just don't even get considered, you know, as a buyer. But that changed a little bit, you know, after all this mess happened. And then, but I've, you know, we even have a seller, you know, recently that had said, you know, they want no financing contingencies whatsoever. And we're like, wait a minute, you know, we're talking almost $500,000 going hard and no financing contingency. So it's a lot to work through. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Absolutely. And that's what you want to be careful of. I have seen those deals. Absolutely. My clients are historically more of the syndicating type where they take the deal down, organize them, and then typically they have investors in queue already. A lot of people will do their raising sort of on the front end, building those relationships. A lot of my guys are going the 506B, as in boy, route, right? And because they're taking contributions from non-accredited investors. So they're doing all that relationship building on the front end. They say, okay, once we've got some soft commitments, then we'll go find our target, take the deal down, syndicate this thing, wrap it up with subscription documents, et cetera, and move forward. At which point, if you have that, maybe the financing can be reeled in a little bit, right? That's where you're going to see shorter inspection periods, shorter financing contingencies, But you never know with the lender itself what their appetite's going to be. Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae typically require an economic occupancy of 85 to 90%. Well, you can imagine with COVID of late, not in a deal right now that we're salvaging, fortunately, I believe, but the economic occupancy had some impact from these non-paying tenants, and they're kind of sheltered under the government, you know, moratorium on evictions. COVID has thrown some wrinkle in some things, but, you know, nonetheless, we want to make sure that in financing period that we've covered our bases.
Okay, we better move on the timeline. We went through the earnest money, financing contingency. Anything else you want to hammer on through the timeline?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about closing. Let's talk about our friends at the lender, right? So they've got a whole cache of documents that they need, and they want them the way they want them, okay? So I could look like a pro. I can do this in my sleep, but it's probably only going to be with one lender, okay? Because each lender has its own parameters. Now, it's easier when you go Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae. They have their own particular requirements. The most complex thing for me to put together really is the org chart, because there's all these little nuanced things that, frankly, you can glean from the documents. It's just something nice, almost a cover page. But what happens in closing, and I want you to know this from your attorney, because I want you to really thank them at the end of the process when the deal closes, because of all the stuff that we've got to do to get your documents organized. They go very scrupulously through these documents, operating agreements, et cetera, signature blocks and all that. And so any edits that have to be made at last minute are very pretty tedious. So how about yesterday, we had a closing for a piece of property in Corpus Christi. So this piece of property did close, but here's the escrow agent who's like, hey, wait a second, your PSA assignment from my client's asset manager to the holdings company, the operating entity, didn't have two letters in the name. And so we had to kind of scramble at the last moment. Of course, it's all DocuSign, and had to send that out, get that adjusted. And fortunately, that was the only real sweat on the brow yesterday. But those are the little things that we do to pull together. Hopefully your lender is giving you a good checklist on the front end. That will be one that's going to be for the guarantors, the other, of course, for legal. And then we'll pull that stuff together for you, send it off. Hopefully CC you on those emails so you've got some visibility to that. Then it closes, the wires are made, the settlement statement is signed, everything is completed, and that asset is yours. And then the real rodeo begins, right?
That's right. Anything post-closing quickly before, you know, you just want to bring out some pitfalls and ways we can prevent them.
Yeah. So post-closing, okay, most of the time, the things that are going to hang over are, obviously, we're going to have all security deposits and other lingering bad debts and things. Be careful of bad debt. Make sure that you can account for that as best you can. Holdover tenants, that's going to be in rent rolls and things. So it's good to see that. But number one, you want to see what problems from the tenants that you're going to adopt at closing. All right, provide for those as best you can on the front end. Next is latent defects on the property. If you don't have an as-is, where-is, with all thoughts disclaimer, you could go back based on representations made by the seller and maybe get some credit, but it's going to be difficult. Just make sure your reps and warranties are nice and clean. That means that the property has been operated in the ordinary course of business and nothing held over, because I can tell you it's extremely difficult to go back after closing and try and get anything from a seller. They've already gotten their money, they've gotten their wire, and you're going to have to pay me to maybe get a credit back in some form or fashion. And then lastly, make sure your contracts are already assigned, or that we have the assignments, change in control and these other things, property management, landscape, cable, electric, all these other things in queue so that there's no lag time, because you don't want your tenants necessarily to suffer, or because there was, you know, not the best planning as you get to closing. So
awesome. Any other pitfalls, Nick, that we haven't discussed that you want to highlight that you see people having trouble with?
Be very wary of good faith deposits when you're going to your lender. Okay. Now, when you're dealing with Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and you're going through a broker, okay, a mortgage broker, just be very wary of what the fees are that are non-refundable. Typically, they want an X percentage or a flat fee as the good faith deposit. Now, that good faith deposit is applied to the attorneys and title and all of these other folks, underwriters and things. That's the cost of reviewing the deal. Once you pay that, you're never going to see it again. They're going to be able to justify somehow the payment of all this stuff that they did on the back end. So if you go through financing, put down your good faith deposit, and then you can't syndicate the deal and you can't close it on that end, you're not getting that $12,500 back from the lender. They're going to say, sorry, you know, kind of cost of doing business. Also be wary on your attorney's fees. So here's what I do just to break down. This should be the benchmark. It's not. It should be. You want where you can put a deposit up front with your attorney and then have a success fee on the back end. Let's say take a ballpark $10,000 flat fee. You want to be able to pay $5,000 to $6,000 up front to get everything going, then a success fee on the back end. If you don't even get through due diligence, then at that point, you want to be able to be absolved of any further responsibility on that fee. And frankly, the lawyer didn't earn it all because you didn't even get out of due diligence. So basically, I did a PSA for $5,000. Now, there is a risk on the front end, but that's the only exposure you have. Most of the attorneys out here are charging $10,000+, and that doesn't include title and escrow. So your settlement fees and all of that are going to be an additional $5,000 to $10,000, depending on the property. But what you don't want to do is be in $10,000. You lose it in due diligence because the roof falls through and there's insurance loss runs, a building burned down and all this stuff. And now you're out $10,000 and you didn't even get anything for it. So be very wary of those attorney's fees. I work nationally because this is a federal program. If you'd like to talk more about that, I'd be happy to. But don't get taken to the cleaners by the lenders, by your sellers, by your attorney. Get a guy like me. I'm hard-nosed with a soft heart. And that's what you need, an attorney.
It's just a great example of why you have to have someone like Nick on your team. I mean, it's just a must. There's just no way of doing these types of deals. And, you know, we're buying, you know, $30 to $50 million properties. And there's no, I couldn't imagine doing it without an attorney, somebody that's guiding you through all these pitfalls that just like Nick is talking about. There's no way I can know them all. That's why we have A players, you know, and attorneys, including attorneys like Nick on our team, that can help us see those things just from their experience. Nick, you know, moving to a few final questions, anyone that has a successful business has a high level of self-discipline. And how did you gain a high level of self-discipline?
I think because I wasn't for a very long time. In my youth, I was very youthful and had to play catch up a lot in my adult years. And the only way to overcome those years of youthfulness was discipline. And I realized that, and I came from a blessed family and had a blessed childhood, but not to the extent that I didn't have to work, right? And I realized I did enjoy the finer things in life. I aspired for more. And the only way to do that was through my education, through self-discipline, exercise, mental fitness, spiritual fitness, and those items. So I wake up early. I try to exercise every day at 7 a.m. for at least an hour. I try to run, eat well. I've got a family that enjoys eating good food as well. I like to cook. And all of these things translate through your life. And I take that same discipline at home and I bring it to the office. Or if I'm working from home, I bring it to the next room and sit down. But Whitney, like I told you, I just love what I do. And discipline, even though it's discipline, it's easier to do when you have a passion for it. And when you believe the positive qualities that you're getting as a product of that discipline. So me, it's just kind of a perpetual motion kind of thing. And it's just provided such abundance in my life.
Are there a couple daily habits that you have that you're very disciplined about that have helped you achieve success?
I'm a man of faith, so I've got a personal relationship with God and certainly self-reflection, introspection, and prayer every day, exercise and eating well, and really, truly just trying, waking up, putting forward that effort. Every day, there are no days off. There's no laying in bed. I mean, I'm an entrepreneur. I have my own law practice. And so when I look at my beautiful family and my beautiful home, I have a responsibility to that. But there's nothing, you know, really where I'm like kind of ritualistic almost, nothing sort of like that. But my day to day is very similar between the focusing on diet, exercise, faith, and just spending time with the family and disconnecting. As much as I love the work, disconnecting is a critical part.
What's a way you've recently improved your business that we could apply to ours?
Consult your financial experts. We can't be everybody in the room. You know, you want to rely and take those, that worry and anxiety out of certain areas of your life and give them to the experts and pay for it. Pay for it. Somebody pays you for what you do best. It's okay to pay it forward and put these people in positions in your life to do their best for you. You cannot fail if you take that approach.
What's the number one thing that's contributed to your success?
Faith and family. I've just been blessed with a strong mind and I apply it. And I read and I do things that stimulate the mind on a daily basis. And it just changes you in such a positive way. And hopefully it's contagious. And then when you start surrounding yourself with people of that like mind and that love your energy and help boost yours and you boost them.
How do you like to give back?
So right now, with as busy as I am, it's really been more financial. So I like to contribute to the church. I like to contribute to our benevolence fund so that that kind of goes out into the community a bit more, food banks, things of that nature. You know, and as my time frees up, I like to get involved a little bit more on an in-person volunteering basis. Obviously, that's been curtailed a bit by the COVID. But giving back is also working with clients in such a way who come to me who don't have the blank check, and being able to do things is such a tremendous value, and knowing that my efforts and talents are helping them and their family. So there's kind of a perpetual giving in that regard. I don't think I've ever sent anybody an actual full invoice. I might start doing that, but so far, I do just fine taking haircuts and giving back to my clients on that front.
Nick, I'm grateful to have met you and appreciate you just sharing today just your level of expertise and experience and just going through this transactional timeline and pitfalls that the listener needs to know about. And I think whether you are a passive investor or you're an operator, either one, you need to understand some of these things so you can, you're on the operator side, you better know them or have somebody, you know, that's on your side of counsel like yourself, Nick, or even as a passive investor. It just gives you good questions to ask your operator, you know, have they thought through these things and understand that they're protecting themselves. So grateful for your time, Nick. Tell the listeners how they can get in touch with you and learn more about you.
I do have a website. It's capitallawgroup.co, not .com, but .co. My email is nmore@capitallawgroup.co. If you just Google my name, it comes up with my law firm, and I think it comes up with a couple other articles and things, including the super lawyers thing, which is a very humbling experience. We don't get a lot of accolades out here, so that recognition was terrific. So there's a link for bio in there. You can message me on LinkedIn, Nicholas G. Moore, bald beard, you know, yellow necktie. That's me. Has syndication moniker on it so that you know who you're getting. And I'd love to answer any questions or help guide you through the process, or like I said, be that bulldog with a soft heart that can get these deals done for you.
Awesome. That's a wrap. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. Don't go yet. Thank you for listening to today's episode. I would love it if you would go to iTunes right now and leave a rating and written review. I want to hear your feedback. It makes a big difference in getting the podcast out there. You can also go to the Real Estate Syndication Show on Facebook so you can connect with me, and we can also receive feedback and your questions there that you want me to answer on the show. Subscribe too so you can get the latest episodes. Lastly, I want to keep you updated. So head over to lifebridgecapital.com and sign up for the newsletter. If you're interested in partnering with me, sign up on the Contact Us page so you can talk to me directly. Have a blessed day, and I will talk to you tomorrow.
Thank you for listening to the Real Estate Syndication Show, brought to you by LifeBridge Capital. LifeBridge Capital works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate, while also donating 50% of its profits to assist parents who are committing to adoption. LifeBridge Capital. Making a difference, one investor and one child at a time. Connect online at www.lifebridgecapital.com for free material and videos to further your success.